everyone, and welcome back to Projector Room, the podcast that you love, and we love you too. And we're right at the tail end of October. It's show 196. Sure, yeah. Shush, be quiet in the back there. Be quiet in the stalls. The end of October. 196 is the show number. And I'm joined as usual by Gareth and that noisy oik Alan in the background there.
Hurrah!
Hurrah!
How you doing, lads?
We're back, yes, with another show, as we do every fortnight, and we hope to talk to you about film, cinema and TV as we go forward. Projectorroom.co.uk is our website, and of course the Movie Group is where we pluck the pearls from our precious members. Let's start there, shall we, Alan?
No precious member jokes. Right, thanks, Ted. Callie Ong reports on Tempest from 2025, a 9-episode Korean drama. Oh, this sounds like your neck of the woods, Ted. It's from Disney Plus, and Callie Ong says, a former UN ambassador got embroiled in a spy and espionage web that threatens to destabilize the Korean Peninsula. Her husband was murdered, and it sparked off the series of events that implicated her as the mastermind. There's a mysterious mercenary in the mix with questionable motives, out to protect her from all parties. They join hands to unravel the murder and its reason. This is an ambitious but uneven effort for a Korean espionage drama, which spans South Korea, USA, China, North Korea, and Iraq. The writers tried their best to weave in a family feud, international politics, espionage romance, and spice it up with dollops. That's our favourite word. Not of romance this time, but of action. Dollops of action. The espionage storyline is pretty predictable, but the twist behind the murder is quite well done, with red herrings thrown in. The Korean cast tried its best to hold the drama together, with the chemistry between the leads shining through. The 9 episodes are well-paced, with one twist after another. Not a must-see, says Callie Ong, but easy to binge. So thank you for that very, very nice review there, Callie Ong. So, Ted, does this float the boat?
That's, I think so. I did try to watch the first episode of this before recording, but I didn't get to it. But it does look quite interesting. I do like the whole Korean scene, as you inferred earlier. So thanks, Carly Ong. I'll be the one that takes that forward of the team here, I think, and have a look at it with you, for you, by you, all the rest of it. So thank you very much. Okay, Paul Williams emailed again, Gareth.
Oh, Ted, sorry. You have to do this in an Iron accent, please.
What?
You have to do this one in a Northern Iron accent.
Why?
Because it's Northern
Iron. Blue light, so it is.
Is that a Northern Ireland thing?
You know full well it is, Ted.
Honestly, I didn't know that. I don't know if Paul Williams is Northern Ireland or Irish, but he's the chappie who emailed us on the last show, and we were all very surprised to get an email. And he emailed me instead this time, instead of you.
Good anyway, man, Paul, yourself.
Blue Lights is a series which apparently was on the BBC, is on the BBC iPlayer. He's talking about Series 3. He dipped in and out of series 1 and 2, and it was okay, but I wasn't blown away by it, says Paul. The third series follows police officers who deal with relationships, career, and the dangers associated with policing, and it can certainly be watched as it is without having done 1 and 2. There must have been a new writer or director in series 3, as it's better, and each episode leaves you wanting more. It touches on parliamentary involvement and human vulnerabilities where there is a common goal for peace. We also see the dark side of policing, how there always seems to be secrets. The final scene at the roll call left me feeling warm inside and wanting more. There's great acting by Shane Bradley and Neil Keary. Neil, in particular, who is not in every episode but plays a very strange and caring person who would be an interesting person with whom to have a pint down the pub. It'll be interesting to gain the views of Alan and Gareth on this if they fancy watching it. So that explains why he's nominating you two. And I had no idea it was anything to do with Ireland. Take it away.
Well, Gareth, have you seen any of this?
I watched a couple of episodes of the first season. I've worked with Martin McCann before. Alan, I imagine you probably have too. It was a fairly decent show, but it was a wee bit of that kind of cringy, can't handle the Belfast accent for so long on television. Until, you know, it's over and then you go, fair enough. But everybody talks about this show round about where I work and things like that. Whenever it's on, it's, did you see it last night? And talking about the plot strands and all that kind of thing. So, Alan, what do you think?
I haven't seen it, but I have heard that it's pretty good. And like yourself, I've picked up on a lot of colleagues and friends, both, you know, just outside of filmmaking interests and within it, who have talked about it a fair bit. And I'm hoping to get an interview for, or an audition for the next season, which should be filming soon. They're starting to cast for it relatively soon. And the casting director is the same person that I did the last two movies with, and I previously played an RUC officer, or what would now be a PSNI officer, in the Good Vibrations movie, if you remember back in the day. So, yeah, that's my personal vested interest. But I, you know, I always hold off on shows, especially if I haven't been cast in them, because I get resentful. You know, it's happened a number of times where I've done bad auditions, or I did a good audition but just wasn't right for the part, and then it's kind of spoiled the show for me, because I can't really separate the professional and the personal as well as I should. But there you have it. I'm hearing good things overall, basically.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. Ted, you will have to sit down and watch it then.
I honestly, I know nothing about it. I've never heard of it. So, but if everyone's recommending it, it sounds as though, from what Paul's saying, though, that one and two is not worth bothering with. Just jump to season three.
And I think Paul's also saying is that you can dip into it, can't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. It strikes me that it's probably something like, you know, a Northern Irish version of The Wire in tone, I would think. It's quite, involved in the personal lives and so on. I think it hits a wee bit heavier than some of the previously cheesy stuff that's on offer.
Okay. I watched the first season of The Wire. And I'd had enough of it by the end of the first season. It wasn't really for me. But yeah, I mean, blue lights, okay. Third season, I'll jump in and follow Paul's advice.
Cool beans. You make sure you do some. Otherwise, we'll be knocking on your door.
Well, Phil Harding has written in about The Chair Company, which is a new 8-part series on Sky and Now TV, which he says is a curious mix of office-based comedy and edge-of-the-seat mystery thriller. Tim Robinson plays project manager Ron. He's always really good, actually, Tim Robinson. Ron has recently been promoted to oversee the construction of a new shopping mall. Things swiftly go downhill at his presentation when his chair collapses. This triggers a crusade to speak to the chair company. When his chair collapses, he incidentally looks up a colleague's skirt, which runs a parallel narrative as he battles HR. There are some big laughs as he gets in over his head with shady dealings of the mystery company while having to deal with the monotony of office life. Oddly, this reminded me of a mystery that David Cronenberg might produce. So think The Office meets Videodrome, and it comes highly recommended from Phil. Thanks, Phil. Yes, I've heard a great amount of reports about this, and I think even one of those kind of clickbaity news articles said that the finest TV show of 2025, you should be watching this, and that made me click on it, and it was this. Either of you two heard of this?
I haven't. I like that pitch of The Office meets Videodrome via Cronenberg. That sounds good.
It does, yeah.
And also the upskirt component, I'm not going to lie.
I don't think it's going to be wall-to-wall upskirts. I think it'll
sadly
be one flash, if anything.
I do remember the furore, if you will, when Basic Instinct came out. And I was working with a bunch of middle-aged ladies at the time, and they were like scandalized by seeing it in the cinema. And they said, the camera goes under the table and you see everything. And of course, I had to phone in sick that day to rush off to the cinema. yeah, it was a good movie. But
I remember that being out on video. I was working in a video library at the time, much like Quentin Tarantino did. That's yeah. one of the many things we share, aside from looking silly. And there was a guy who came in and complained that that sequence was unwatchable. And I was like, well, you know, it's quite evocative, and it's groundbreaking. He went, no, yeah. the tape is worn down, and I couldn't. Oh, right, you want me to find another copy then?
Hilarious and revolting in equal measure. Yeah, I remember Wayne Knight's kind of, he's nearly exploding with lust, and he's sweating and trembling in that scene, isn't it? Wayne Knight, you call the actor who, you know, the guy from Jurassic Park and Seinfeld.
Yes.
Yeah, he was terrific in it. He really channeled the thirsting of the male populace there. No bother. Well, may I proceed then to Chad's report, Ted?
Why not?
You may. I was just looking through Tim Robinson and seeing if there's anything. Yeah. I can't place him, and I was looking through his credits to see if there's anything to help me place him, and there's not. There's nothing. I kind of half recognise his face, but.
I'm going to do the same as we speak because I was getting confused with Tim Robbins. No, I don't know this fella. Okay. I don't know this fella.
Oh, it's Tim Robbins.
No, I don't recommend him. I don't recognize him from anything.
Okay.
So it's not just me. Anyway, Chad Dixon has been good enough to report on King and Conqueror 2025, 8 parts from BBC iPlayer. And Chad says, the show takes significant liberties with historical facts and the timeline, 1042 to 1066. The narrative centres on the power struggle for the English crown following the death of King Harthac Canute, involving the houses of Wessex, Godwin and Normandy. Emma of Normandy, played by Juliet Stevenson, schemes to secure the throne for her weak son, Edward the Confessor, Eddie Marson. The Godwins are a key family, with the prominent Harold, played by James Norton, and his sister Gunhild, Beau Braggeson, who is queen to Edward. Simultaneously, Emma's great-nephew, William of Normandy, Nikolai Coster-Waldau, is embroiled in a power struggle with the King of France. The production is lavish and cinematic, with authentic-looking period costumes and weapon technology, and strong supporting performances. The series excels in its combat sequences, featuring numerous bloody and realistic skirmishes leading up to the clash at Hastings. While the script is exposition-heavy and the series feels 2 episodes too long, the performances are believable. The strong chemistry between the leads, Harold and William, carries the plot as the once amicable distant relatives are slowly transformed into mortal enemies by these constant power struggles. So that sounds kind of my neighbourhood, although I do really recoil at the notion of BBC taking quote-unquote significant liberties with historical facts, because I can only imagine what that's referring to given some of the other productions. However, broadly speaking, I do like the sound of this, and some of the cast. Your fella from Game of Thrones, whose name I butchered there, is it Nicola Coster-Waldau?
I go with that. Yeah, that's a good go.
He was terrific in Game of Thrones. So, have either of you seen this?
No, but I'm glad that the BBC are taking the time to point out that William was actually transsexual, and it's not well known, but
that
needs to be addressed, and finally has been addressed.
He was King adjacent.
That's right.
Yeah, very
just
good.
To the left.
Yeah. Okay. Well, where does that leave us, Ted?
I'm just trying. I'm doing the same thing with Nikolai to try and track him down.
He's a very handsome guy. He played. He played Jaime Lannister in Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I haven't seen Game of Thrones, so I was trying to find something else that I knew him from, because I do recognise the name.
Did we watch The Silencing? I think we did, as part of our private screening, The Silencing. Or at least we talked about it on the show.
Oh, okay.
It was a very good little foresty-style thriller where he's in the forest trying to track down someone who killed his or kidnapped his daughter or something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I remember that now. Right, okay. King and King and Conqueror, by the way, Chad Dixon's full review. That's an excerpt from it, a summary. it's quite extensive, and he's posted that in the group and on my blog as well. So links to that will be in the show notes as usual. Flop of the Fortnight is next, and I watched this film called All the Lost Ones from 2024. It's on Apple TV. I really wouldn't bother. It's a load of badly acted, poorly scripted, badly written rubbish. It's supposed to be set in this dystopian future America, torn apart by civil war. There's a group of annoying teenagers, generally, hiding in this remote cabin in the woods. And they become the target of this ruthless rebel militia platoon. Who are trying to kind of establish some order, post-apocalypse thing, you know, sort of thing. So they're all kind of hunting people down and blah, blah, blah. But it's just so irritating. All of the characters are really, really irritating, unconvincing. And to make it even worse, nothing of note at all happens in the first hour. They may as well have just completely missed out the first hour, where they're just farting around, getting to know each other and trying to establish who the characters are and where they fit in. But actually, it's so boring and crap. It's totally unnecessary. It feels very much like a badly put together director DVD title. The music is crappy as well. It's boring, dull as dishwater. Be warned, don't watch it. Flop of the Fortnight, All the Lost Ones, 2024. Next.
Oh, well, no, I watched a bit of the teaser trailer there, and I just would have been happily involved in that civil war, dispatching any of those idiots that came my way. Yeah. I share your contempt for this, and I, you know, thank you for taking one for the team.
No, that's fine.
Well, I'm going to take one for the team as well, because I quite fancy this. I like Jasmine Matthews, and it's also got Steve Aug in it as well. So I'm going to give this a go, just to see if the two of you are talking out your bottoms.
Yeah. Why does that not surprise me, Gareth? When civil war comes, we'll be on either side of the divide. You know, you with Bruce and me with, I don't know, I'll find somebody. Ted, maybe Hayden.
Yeah, we'll team up, don't you worry.
We'll team up, exactly.
Yeah, right. Gareth, what have you brought to Flop of the Fortnight?
Well, I brought the first of two bus movies that we're talking about. And actually, I believe that we had the original film in this series in Flop of the Fortnight when it first arrived, and it was called Ice Road.
I remember that.
With Liam Neeson, yeah.
Liam.
Believe it or not, it managed to get a sequel.
Right.
And I watched it on Netflix out in the States some time ago. Now, I will say I had to watch it in two goes because my brother's television has all of the forced effects and things like that on, so it all looked really poor, you know, where it sort of it increases the frame rate and increases the color palette and things like that. So it looked terrible, like it would have been shot on a really high powered iPhone or something. The whole way through, and all the effects looked really bad and poor, so I had to turn it off halfway through. And then I watched it when I got home on my TV, which is sensibly set up, unlike his. And it looked a lot better, but that didn't help the fact that the film was still pretty bad. I'm not going to say that it's terrible, because I did sit through it and I actually enjoyed a few moments. But it just everything, the whole logistics of the film was really frustrating, because it's all set on this bus. And they're constantly fighting people and taking down other people as the bus is trying to travel across a Nepalese road, you know, a roadway around Everest with giant cliffs and things like that. And the bus falls over and breaks axles and things like that. And they're able to fix it using, you know, knicker elastic and gum from their shoes. It defies logic in so many ways, but it's it's not trying to be anything other than just a stupid, enjoyable action movie. And that didn't really feel apparent in the first one, but it feels more apparent with this one because it has a sense of humor about itself. It's not a very funny sense of humor at all, but it still has a sense of humor and it doesn't take itself too seriously. So I did actually start to enjoy it as it went on, but it took a while to get through it. And I wouldn't recommend it to anyone, but, you know, if you're absolutely shit-faced and you need something to watch while you're eating curry, this would probably be...
He knows us too well, Ted.
I'll tell you what we liked about the first film, I remember, having just reminded myself by looking at the IMDb page, was Amber Midthunder. And I think we all agreed that she was actually... Is she in this sequel?
She's not... but she's replaced by, well, not replaced, but there's another character there who's sort of filling her position called Bing Bing Fan, and she's really good. She's ass-kickingly good.
Right. Okay. It sounds like a character out of Austin Powers. Really nice.
Well, she's Chinese. She's got a different name. So, but the cast is relatively good. One particular actor is, I think, Bernard Curry. I think no, maybe it's not. I can't remember who it is. Gertie, maybe no, I can't remember. But he's really bad. He plays the father of one of the kids that's on the bus, and it's actually you can see him kind of fiddling with his hands while he's delivering some of the dialogue because I don't think he knows what to do with his hands. He's a bit nervous, or he's having trouble delivering this clanky dialogue in one of the scenes. He doesn't survive the film, so the sooner he's killed.
No spoilers.
I want to see what I didn't the character a what
or whatever you call it.
No, she's lovely. She deserves her own movie. If they make another one, make it about her.
I always think it's interesting that, you know, for Chinese people or people in other parts of the world, they might find our banal, ordinary names incredibly glamorous and compelling, just as we do with theirs. Jeffrey Majimpsey. Oh, what a cool name, you know. good on you, Jeffrey, if you're listening tonight.
Well, that's it. Ted Salmon, he's named after a fish. Ho, 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 ho.
I went into the Boots the Chemist a while back, and there's a whole team of people behind the counter, like about 12 people. And when I announced my name, they all looked up and said, "Ted Salmon, that is such a cool name." And I was
happy days.
Yeah, I thought, they must have all been talking about me and waiting for me to come in.
You not just go, look at me, everyone. Look at me. Are you not entertained?
I said to them, "What do you mean? A cool name?" They couldn't explain it. It just sounds so cool. It looks so cool. So there you go. I arrived. Days, yeah,
I bet you're dead chuffed.
I've quite fancy.
But then as you left, a little old lady walked in past you and you heard them at the counter and they went, "Molly Goggins, what a cool name."
I quite fancy this film. I really quite enjoyed the first one, probably more than most people on the panel. And I think that this second one looks like a bit of a scream. And I'm going to watch it, regardless of it being in Flop of the Fortnight, and prove you wrong. There you go. I'll get my own back on you.
Well, I feel bad putting it in there because I did... kind of enjoy it. I got up from it afterwards and went, "What a load of crap." And that's rich coming from me.
Yes. Anyway, I'm going to give it a go. So there you go. Now, talking of people on buses, the private screening challenge I threw out was this new film on Apple TV called The Lost Bus. And it's the survival drama film directed by Paul Greengrass, which is based on the 2021 book Paradise by Lizzie Johnson about the 2018 campfire. Now, I have to admit, before I'd looked at any of this or saw this coming, I did not remember it at all, but it was a fearsome, horrible fire that took over the town of Paradise in California in 2018 and killed lots of people, basically destroyed the town. But the film And certainly, before I go back to the film, there is also another documentary been made by Ron Howard, believe it or not, about the same event. And this is available on Disney Plus. It's called Rebuilding Paradise, and it is very much about that. It's about that he stitches together some of the footage from the real events of the time, but over the course of the following year, he documents the people trying to rebuild their town, and it's very moving in many ways, but and you can tell that it's a documentary made by a filmmaker. It's really well done, well shot, well produced, and it's worth a look if you get the chance. But back to the film, The Lost Bus. This is they focus in on one kind of story in the middle of all this chaotic stuff about this bus driver who has got lots of troubles personally, and he goes and rescues a bunch of 22 children from a school because they've got no way of getting out. They're certainly all going to die if no one goes and gets them, and so the story really depicts that whole story inside the story and how they he went and got them and rescued them, and they all survived. I really thought it was very good. I'm going to turn to Alan. Did you get a chance to watch this?
I did, and I watched it today, and it was an interesting film. I couldn't quite work out exactly how to score it, but what did it do well? I thought that the acting was mostly good. Occasionally very good, but also occasionally very bad. So I guess the main thing is a kind of unevenness. Visually, I think that was what the big achievement of the film was. The visual effects were consistently immersive and believable, and also wildly complex and difficult. So I was very, very impressed with how convincing the recreation of that fire was, and you know, just things like, you know, the amount of smoke in the scenes, the kind of continuity of the lighting, how dark and oppressive certain sequences were, all that stuff's difficult enough to do just with locked off cameras on tripods, but as no doubt you will be very aware, Paul Greengrass seems to hate tripods, and so for the post-production team, they then have to match all the crazy camera movement with the backgrounds that they're painting in and all the foreground components and all the compositing. So it's exponentially more difficult to do an already difficult job. I thought that was really good. And it was only in rare occasions did you ever kind of think, well, that's a bit CGI. For the most part of the whole thing, it just felt consistent and coherent and convincing. So performances were good, as you would expect. He's a sort of actor's director. He's very good at the ensemble pieces. So I thought those set pieces where there's, you know, the control room stuff he tends to do very, very well. And any films that I've seen of his, particularly United 93 was very convincing. The one about the 9/11 plane, and a lot of the stuff in the air traffic control room was brilliantly boggling. You know, you didn't get any exposition from it. You were just in the middle of that and you couldn't understand what they were saying, but you got the gist of it because the whole thing was so technical. And I love that. What I didn't like in this was that there were several scenes I thought were really badly written in terms of dialogue, very, very expositional, almost soap opera, and devoid of subtext. So there was a lot of really on the nose dialogue about it. Characters overtly explaining to each other feelings that, you know, they both know anyway. And so they were really, it just felt like this is for the benefit of the audience in case they're not quite able to ascertain what, you know, the nuances of this relationship, which of course most people were. And I also found the opening sort of 10 minutes discombobulating to the point of nausea, where I just kind of thought, if this guy doesn't put the camera on a tripod at some point, You know, where does he? Because that's just at the opening scenes where he's picking up the kids from the school. It's a lovely, bright summer's day. This is the act one, establish the normal world of the characters. And, you know, you're thinking that needs a contrast for later on. But the opening sequence is shot like the opening sequence of Saving Private Ryan. It's terrifyingly kind of shaky, running camera. Cameras on a big long lens, dashing here, there, and everywhere. I was thinking, like, my gosh, he's letting kids onto a bus. It was nearly farcically over-egged, I thought. And then I worried, like, where's he going to go for the visual underscore, if you like, the visual emphasis for the big action sequences. However, I thought it did deliver, and it was a moving story. I mean, it was very, very, you know, it was horrifying to contemplate what happened to these people and what they endured. And of course, by implication, you know, what happened to the people who didn't make it through. So, like you said, Ted, I hadn't taken on the specifics of this particular tragedy. I've just sort of, in the back of my mind, there's just seemed to be a lot of wildfires in California in particular over the last decade. It did no harm to kind of think about that a little bit more, think about, you know, the fallout for people. And also I was glad to see that the responsibility for the event was squarely, you know, addressed at the end of the movie. The big takeaway for me was how strong the supporting lead, the boss in the bus depot was. I thought she really kind of stole the show. And there's some very strong performances from some of the children, and also the girl who played the school teacher, Matthew McConaughey, you can rely upon to be superb. But I always felt I was watching Matthew McConaughey giving a good performance rather than another strange actor, you know, that you weren't distracted by the celebrity. And I think that in some instances you could see where he has called upon maybe firefighting professionals or emergency service professionals to reenact scenes rather than professional actors, because there's a couple of bits that just felt very, very clunky. And again, just brought you out of the immersion of the film. So for me, a mixed but uneven overall. And above all, I was just, I don't know if it was me and my energy levels or what, but I was less involved in the outcome than I had anticipated. Obviously, I knew that it was a story of people who survived the event. I was just a little bit less involved than I would have liked to have been in the film. Gareth, what did you think of it?
I kind of agree with you in that it felt very much like a bigger budget kind of TV movie where you had Matthew McConaughey, the sort of central lead performance, and then they had packed in a couple of actors around him who weren't quite up to the level of Matthew McConaughey so that he would shine more. And I know they do that in certain movies to really, you know, if he's chasing an Oscar or some sort of win, they'll maybe downplay the cast, or perhaps they'll take a concession on the cast to be able to get a bigger name in there to get more of a draw. You know, like where you get Brad Pitt put in a movie, you'll have a smaller cast around it because they can't afford to have bigger names. But I felt that was maybe in play here. But in saying that, America Ferrera, who played the school teacher along for the ride, she was terrific. She was downplayed a wee bit.
She
did very well with what she had. I don't know the entire story of what happened here, but they I just got a notification that this meeting will end in 15 minutes.
That's interesting.
Right. Ted, you might have some editing to do. The film is, it doesn't feel like they've tried to shoehorn in a love story or something like that, like they do so many times, like they give it the Titanic treatment, where they want to try and tell a more personal story or a more romantic story or an American story or something like that. This does seem to be more about what actually happened, and let's make a drama out of that, those facts, and that comes across. And I hope that that's what it is, either that or they just, you know, they rushed it maybe. If they were trying to jigger around with the story because they didn't pack in too much to keep the audience interested. But the audience, I feel, is still interested in the story because it is a story of regular, average, everyday heroism, and you know, just going against the odds and making it through, which is exceptional. Paul Greengrass is the right kind of guy to do this sort of thing. He's very good at these sorts of things, but his filming style, as you say, Alan, doesn't quite lend itself to more traditional storytelling, where a lot of people may turn this off after a while, going, "Oh, I've had enough. You know, I don't want to watch the Blair Witch Project. Yes. I'm going to start feeling sick in a minute. Can we not just get in like a typical director to set up the sticks with the camera on top of it and get filming? It works that way. And some of the action-y sequences felt like they were a bit more dressed up, where there was just sort of wild pictures of fire filling the screen to try and paint the picture that you're in there. But they've got something to cut away to, but they don't have too much to cut away to. So it's just, you know, fire licking up that tree and then fire taking down that cabin or whatever. And it's just sort of, you know, cuts to those things to show the bedlam without actually having a real, you know, proper cutaway. But yes, I did enjoy it. I didn't realize how long it was whenever I watched it. It sped past quite quickly. At 2 hours and 10 minutes, you don't notice it going past. So it is that kind of, it's got that going for it in that, there's not much that happens in the film, but it keeps you engrossed the whole way along. And you might have noticed it had it been, 90 minutes long and felt that you were getting a bit shortchanged. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I did. I'm picking faults with it, but they're just faults that other people may have problems with, more so than I had problems with. Ted, back to you.
I think, what you two have summarised has been very insightful, I must say. I thought that the most annoying bit was the handheld camera work, as you say, Alan, right from the start. And I almost kind of thought, oh, good grief, I can't stand. But as you say, once the action gets going, it legitimises that approach to filming. And it's okay then, and that's fine. The documentary, the Ron Howard documentary, fills in some of the gaps and tells some of the truths that the film does not do. For example, in the real story, there's two female teachers on the bus with the driver, for example, and one of the female teachers had asked when they made The Lost Bus, she didn't want her character, her name to be in there. So they had to change the story.
That's interesting. You know,
there are lots of little things that come out of the documentary like that. And also the build up to the compensation that everyone got and how the company, there's one scene in the documentary where the guy, representing the electricity company is facing the community, and to be honest, he's almost in tears, and he's been told to go and face the community, and this is real footage, and he's standing there saying he's got no defense, and he's holding his hands out to the community representing the company. It's not his personal fault, of course, but
sounds so disturbing and distressing.
It is. Some of that footage in the documentary, Ron Howard has just done so well, and he's depicted everyone. Anyway, I think the two of them together are worth seeing if you get the chance, and perhaps watch the film first like I did and then the documentary afterwards. But yeah, the film I thought was really, really good. And I thoroughly enjoyed it, like Gareth did, and the time flew, and it was really moving, and it was just great. I really, really enjoyed it, and I'm going to give it an 8.
Hey, okay. Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'd go with 8 as well. Maybe 7. Actually, no, I'll go with 7.
Oh, dear. Right,
Alan? I couldn't work out whether it was a 6 just seemed mean-spirited, and 7 just seemed a bit generous. Just, but we'll go with 7.
You're going with 7 too. That makes 22, yeah. Doesn't it? So 22 yeah. puts it in the territory of Sweet Virginia, Smoke, Baby Reindeer. I like that. Yeah, Kung Fu
yeah,
Hustle.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it?
Ooh.
So it's in there about a third of the way down our leaderboard. So yeah, very good.
Sufficiently distanced from the likes of what were our really bad ones?
Virgin River.
Yeah, that yes, well said. That is the bottom of the Marianas Trench.
That's still going, you know. I got a notification the
Are
other
you
day
kidding me?
From IMDb yeah. or something, and it said there's a new series coming out. People clearly love that.
My gran, back in the day, watched a show called Take the High Road, and I think this is the reincarnation of Take the High Road. It's just some
almost Michael Lonsdale, wasn't it?
Yeah, no. yeah, just some yeah. twee, parochial little sort of romantic fantasy thing. I don't know.
Anyway, there you go. That was 22 scored there. And yeah, I think that there's a lot to be said for that and the documentary. So I'll put the links to those in the show notes if you get the chance to watch both of them. Gareth, next show, what are you going to get us to watch?
I'm trying to remember his name now. It was not Michael Lonsdale. That was a guy from, was it Michael Lonsdale?
Michael Landon.
Take the High Road. Landon, that's the one. Little House in the Prairie or one of those. And yeah, yeah. Highway to Heaven. Yeah, gotcha. Right, okay. Well, there's two I'm going to ask you guys to pick. One is a new one. One's an old one. The first is The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. Believe Yay. It or not, there's a remake of hey. A cracking Curtis Hanson film from 1990-whatever with Rebecca De Mornay and yeah. Annabelle Sicori and Matt McCoy.
That was great. I love that film.
Yes, it is. It's an exceptional film, so I'm quite interested to see whether or not the remake is just a tired retread of crap that's sort of modern, updated to throw out in the streaming network as a cheap alternative, or if it's something that's going to recapture that tale for a new generation. I've got a feeling
excuse me, but I beg your pardon.
That. Or in the wake of Play Dirty appearing on Amazon Prime with Mark Wahlberg, which is a Parker movie, I thought I'd investigate another Parker, well, not quite a Parker movie, because Point Blank was a Parker movie. Payback was kind of a Parker movie, but they changed the name to Porter because they didn't have the release on it. But Mel Gibson made another film that was very similar to Payback called How I Spent My Summer Vacation, which is also known as Get the Gringo, back in 2012. And it's a cracker of a thriller that I'd love to watch again. And I'd love to know what YouTube might think about it, because it's just sitting in the back of my head. I need to see it again. So those are the two. The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, something I haven't seen, or How I Spent My Summer Vacation, something I haven't seen. Which do you want?
Where can we watch these? Tubi for How I Spent My Summer Tubi. Vacation.
Yeah.
And the other one is on
Disney Plus.
Disney Plus. I think I have access to both of those. Ted, do you have a strong preference?
Yeah, I do have a strong preference. The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, because I like the original so much. And I've also read a few people that have commented on the remake. And they've said that it's really smart and it doesn't remake it scene for scene or anything silly like that. It takes the bones of the story and remakes it into something new and fresh and interesting. So that was my vote.
Well, I'm happy to run with that then, guys, if that works for you.
Fine by me. And the Rocks the Cradle it is then. And I'll probably watch the original just to draw a contrast.
Sure.
Yeah, good idea. Right, okay. Theme Treats is next. And it was my choice last show, and I chose Roman Polanski, who has got a great backlog of all sorts of films, as we know. We've spoken before about the Apartment trilogy particularly, so Repulsion, Rosemary's Baby we've done a few times, and The Tenant. I watched The Tenant since our last recording because I'd never seen that one, and that was really quite interesting in different ways. But the one that I was going to pick was The Pianist from 2002, where it depicts the events sense of Mr. Spillman as the Holocaust survival. Adrian Brody plays the central role in this, and he plays this kind of Warsaw ghetto in Poland survivor, while Nazi atrocities are going on around him. They find out that he is able to play the piano, so they start abusing him in terms of, treating him like a slave and entertaining them. There's amazing music going on in the background. It's really powerful. It's a real heart-wrenching film and moving, and it reflects very, very powerfully the kind of the horrors of war, and it does it from inside the head of this guy who's picking through all the debris of this ruined city and just trying to survive. And he goes from adventure to adventure. It's all allegedly true. The bit of trivia I had was that the story had deep connections for Polanski, because he himself had escaped the Warsaw ghetto as a child, and his mother was murdered in Auschwitz as well. He ended up living in a Polish farmer's barn until the end of the war. His father almost died in the camps, but he reunited with him after the war. The sad irony being that Polanski's parents were both agnostics, and he was kind of singled out by the Nazis because Polanski's parents were both abused by the Nazis because they thought that they were they were Jewish, but it later turned out that they really weren't. And it's a bit of reading on the background of Polanski, and before he's kind of strung up for the alleged crimes that he committed himself against people in his film directing career, there's some really harrowing stuff from his background going on. But the film, going back to the film, I think that everyone that hasn't watched this should watch it, because it's just so emotional and it gives a really hard line view of what went on during Second World War for those stuck in the ghettos in Warsaw. So I guess that probably, Alan, you will have seen this.
I haven't, actually. And I wasn't aware of his traumatic upbringing either. Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting.
Cool. Okay. Well, that was the one I picked. Gareth, yeah. Have you seen The Pianist?
No, I haven't, but I was totally engrossed in what you were saying there. That was fascinating to hear that. It's very high on my wish list now. Mm-hmm. To watch that, because I would like to get in. That was 2002.
Yeah, wow. And Adrian Brody is just fantastic. He is so amazing in the role. It's so convincing. Really, really good. So yeah, there's a lot behind all of that stuff, and I would strongly recommend people watch it. And also the Apartment trilogy. If no one's watched any of those, put those together, because that's really good fun and very. Oh, we haven't mentioned Halloween yet, have we? This is supposed to be the Halloween show, and there's some kind of nasty stuff going on in some of those Apartment trilogy films as well. So links in the show notes to all of that. Gareth?
I do like Roman Polanski. I've seen a good number of his films over the years. Alan's obviously picked one of my favourite films ever made. And I think it was actually Alan who introduced me to that film, so I'll let him talk about it. But I'm going to talk about two that start with F. The first one, which Roman Polanski is also in, I watched one night on Channel 4 because I had to with this title. It was called The Fearless Vampire Killers, or Dances with the Vampires, which it's also known as, but I prefer Fearless Vampire Killers. And I remember thinking, it's not bad. It's quite funny. I was hoping for a bit more gruesome horror and things like that, but It doesn't quite work that way. It's got Jack McGrowan from The Exorcist. He plays Bert, the film director in The Exorcist, alongside Roman Polanski playing a young protege, essentially, as the two kind of play Van Helsing and the protege as they go around trying to track down vampires in a very snowy and cold medieval style village. Not medieval style, but period village. It's quite good. It's kind of funny. It's worth watching at least once. I wouldn't say it's a cult classic or absolutely something that you need to go out of your way to see. But if it's on Channel 4, 9 o'clock on a Friday night, you could watch it. Do worse.
Looks great.
But the one I really want to... Yeah, it is. have either of you two seen it?
No.
Never heard of it, I don't think.
Yeah, he's quite young in it, so it's one of his early ones. And because he's starring in it as well, it's probably something that he decided not to do again. But I've talked about this other film a few times on the podcast before because I think it's a really underrated thriller, and it's called Frantic, starring Harrison Ford and Emmanuel Sager, who is Roman Polanski's wife. Betty Buckley's also in there as well. And it's about Harrison Ford playing a doctor, not Dr. Richard Kimball, but Dr. Richard Walker. His wife goes missing in Paris, and he has to go and find her. I always felt that Harrison Ford would be a bit miscast here because, you know, this is Indiana Jones and he's playing a slightly older doctor who has trouble with his eyes and he runs upstairs and things like that and he's a bit short of breath. But you couldn't imagine that with Harrison Ford in the main role because he's uber fit and looks like he should be climbing through tombs and things like that and battling aliens on a starship. But, you know, he's there and he does pretty well with it, despite his physical bad casting. I love Frantic right from the opening theme tune. It's a really clever little thriller that I think captures that period of France in the kind of the mid-80s really nicely with all the, you know, the sandstone streets and things like that, and it's a bit dirty, it's a bit rank, it's there's a lot going on in the film, and it, all the zinc roofs and things like that, they're a pretty cool not action sequence but tense sequence as he has to walk across the roofs of the Parisian apartments in order to be able to get into them and things like that. It's worth watching if you haven't seen it. It's a very satisfying thriller. Have either of you two seen this yet after I banged on about it a few times?
No, I haven't. Oh, no, Frantic. Yes, I think I... Yes, I have.
I think I've seen it as well, but I can't remember. How old is it? Oh, 1988.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree
just before
you.
We did Last Crusade.
Yeah, Harrison was kind of too young and fit and cool to be, like, playing an old duffer then.
Yeah, he's playing a sort of 50-year-old. I reviewed this on my blog, and I decided that the perfect casting was already in the film, where the actor David Huddleston plays another doctor in it, and if he had played the lead role, this would have been an absolutely brilliant thriller, because it, just the look of him, you know, he's a sort of bald man, bit overweight with round glasses and things. If you see him running up some stairs trying to chase down some baddies, you know, that it would have been proper edge of the seat stuff with a hero in there.
Has your fella from Frasier, the dad from Frasier's in it?
Yes, yeah, John Mahoney, that's right.
Yeah, John Mahoney.
He's in the American consulate.
I seem to recognise the scenes of the rooftop scrabbling around on the rooftop and nearly falling off the edge. I think I have seen this, yeah, but it certainly is far from my memory, so I should give it another go. That's two I've got lined up, right?
Well, there you go. Alan, talk about...
Yeah, I mean, it's the movie I immediately associate with Polanski, Chinatown. And obviously, you mentioned how much you love it as well. Excellent, excellent 1974 noir movie, and set in, I think, the mid-30s, possibly. And it's Jack Nicholson, Faye Dunaway, and John Huston, the great film director. And the story revolves around some femme fatale who's being investigated by Nicholson, who's this kind of surly, kind of gone to seed private detective. And as he investigates the story, there's intrigue and darkness and love affairs, but increasingly that becomes darker and darker to where there's murder and statewide corruption, and then ultimately a very, very dark secret at the climax of the movie as well. And it's just exceptionally well written, directed, and acted, classic movie. And the trailer is linked in the show notes. What are your thoughts on it, movie lovers?
Jed, go ahead.
I have seen this. We have spoken about it before on the show as well, like some of the others from Polanski. But the it's a long time since I saw it, and I'm watching the IMDb summary trailer thingy as I'm talking, and some of the scenes are coming back to me. Oh yeah, there's Jack Nicholson with a bandage over his nose. I know all this, but I would need to watch it again to remember it all. Yeah,
for some reason it's a movie which completely illogically I associate with Christmas holidays and stuff, along with The Godfather. It always seems to be like something I'll watch at Christmas. And maybe on a rainy afternoon in that lovely twilight zone between Boxing Day and New Year, where nobody's about, and it's just rainy and dark. So it's great blanky weather for box sets. But that's when I tend to lean towards this one.
He's done a lot of films though, hasn't he? Gareth, did you want to talk about Chinatown?
Well, Gareth will have stuff to say.
I don't really have too much to say. I think Alan sort of covered it all. It is absolutely classic thriller with a great plot to it, and quite a bit of takeaway as well as you go along. I would say that it's one of those films that's so strong that I think the sequel is good too, The Two Jakes. I really enjoyed The Two Jakes because I watched the two back-to-back once, and I think I got the most out of it that one time, and that's whenever I really fell in love with the two films. And I always hoped that they would make a third one as well. I know Jack had expressed an interest, but because The Two Jakes didn't do terribly well at the box office, all the studios walked away from it.
Who was the other Jake?
Harvey Keitel.
All right. I'm wondering, have I seen this at some point? I wasn't even aware that there was a sequel. Right.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Must look that out. That sounds really interesting.
And it's directed by Jack Nicholson as well. He bankrolled it, I think, as well. He produced it.
Okay.
So it's absolutely his movie. He wanted it to be the way it was. So it's a personal endeavor that he did.
The other thing I love about Chinatown is that it's Nicholson before he became Jack, you know?
Yeah.
And you just see a very, very fine performance from a great actor, as opposed to kind of like, you know, some of the more flamboyant, kind of coke-fueled Nicholson-esque extravaganzas that are, you know, just so over the top. But it's like you can see in that and Five Easy Pieces, and not so much The Shining, but those early films, you think, wow, he's really something.
Yeah, it is. It's a great introduction to him as well. I'd say anyone who wants to get into the world of Jack Nicholson, because I don't think too many people really do. He's not a film star that translates very well to modern audiences and things. I think he will not be forgotten, but remembered as a classic, but not be as thought of as, say, for example, Harrison Ford, as we just mentioned, because he's got so many popular movies. Jack is someone who you need to experience and then love.
Five Easy Pieces is your homework if you're not a Jack Nicholson fan or you're not familiar with his really, really great work. That is just fantastic movie, and he is amazing in it.
Yeah.
So, Polanski, looking through some of the other titles, I was actually quite surprised at the number of things that I'd seen, and I'd forgotten that I'd seen, and sometimes forgotten if I knew that he actually was the director of it. For example, the 2005 version of Oliver Twist and The Ninth Gate, with Johnny Depp in 1999, and that was a real kind of sinister supernatural kind of tale, which was a gripping film. I nearly highlighted that on the show today, because it's a real, I when I first watched that, I really enjoyed it, and I thought it was ever so well done, and it was really spooky because it's a Halloween-y thing. Then Death and the Maiden we covered on this show in some depth. I can't remember if it was something we did for private screening or not, but we did that, and we all watched it, I think, and it was just a really well done film again. There's so much to you know, just roll back through his titles, and there's just loads of stuff there. So, if you haven't done that, good dear listener, then do have a poke through and see some of those titles. What were you surprised at regarding The Ninth Gate?
I remember watching it and thinking, this is a bit crap.
Oh, okay. But
maybe I need to revisit it again. I think I saw it in the cinema expecting more, you know, a proper horror film or something like that, and not getting it. But Death and the Maiden, we did come to that because it was remade as something that we watched, but I can't remember what it was. And I think I mentioned that to you, and you went back and watched Death and the Maiden.
Was that it?
Possibly.
Right. Yeah, okay. Anyway, there you go. Roman Polanski. Lots of links in the show notes to those films. And hopefully that's been interesting for some of our listeners. Gareth, who are you going to pick for the next show?
Well, I was looking down the list of low-budget direct-to-video directors, and one popped up, but he hasn't made a low-budget direct-to-video film in quite some time. And it's a wee fella called Marty Scorsese. We haven't done him yet.
Right?
So I think it's probably worth having a look at some of his flicks, because I've heard he's made a few decent ones.
Yeah, they say he's going to be good.
Okay. Yeah. Martin Scorsese is, and we'll all bring some thoughts back to the next show on that. Who's that jumping around in their chair? Sit still.
Sorry.
You're standing in the corner. Okay, the main feature. We kind of tried to make this a bit Halloween-ish because it's Halloween around the corner, but I'm not sure if we succeeded, really.
I didn't.
Shall I? I'll tell you what, I'll go first and then hand over. Final Destination is something that Gareth suggested that might be quite interesting for me to watch because I'd never seen it before. Sadly, I found it quite annoying. I watched the first one, the year 2000, and it just felt like, right, the premise of the story is that there's an annoying young man who's on an upcoming plane trip, and he foresees this plane crashing, causes chaos, gets thrown off with six other people from the plane. The plane, sure enough, crashes, 200 plus people dead. Then he has to work out how to stop death, inverted commas, coming to get the seven of them that have survived and cheated death. But it just felt a bit kind of Disney-ish to me. It felt very tame. It felt a bit like people lolloping around as teenagers, like it's Ferris Bueller's Day Off, even with a kind of spunky teen girl in tow, you know. And the FBI agents involved just reminded me of the Ferris Bueller's head teacher. And I don't know, it just didn't feel very much like
Looney's office.
It just didn't feel much like Halloween fodder to me, I don't think. And it just annoyed me. So anyway, I pressed on anyway. I thought, right, okay, I'll do the second one because I've got six of these lined up. The second one was Final Destination. the Final Destination 2 in 2003. And I was hoping that it would be just better, but it wasn't. It was just, they'd focused a bit more on in terms of the grisly death scenes, but it was just more of the same, really. It felt a bit comic. Like, for example, in one scene, there's a bloke that's sliced into three, like you'd see in a Tom and Jerry cartoon. You know, the thing goes across and the three sections. And it's just comic. It's not in any way horror. It's just funny. And at the end of the film, there's an arm or a leg or something flying onto a table. And then you get this kind of comic music cutting in. The second one also particularly had dreadful acting. It was a terrible plot. The teenagers were all irritating. And I gave up at that point. So there's still four of them that I hadn't seen. And frankly, I gave up. So Gareth, tell me where I went wrong.
I don't think you did go wrong. It's designed for, you know, teenagers to have a laugh and sit in a group with all their friends and some of them who you know, if you jump out of your skin at one of the shock moments, everybody laughs at you. It's that kind of movie. It's not maybe something that you sit on your own and watch.
Right.
Yeah, you kind of need, it's audience participation is a big thing in a lot of these horror movies that are designed for the kids, where they sit in the cinema together and watch it. And I think that really makes a difference. It doesn't translate terribly well to streaming unless there's a house party or something and it's on and
everybody's
sitting
pissed
around with their popcorn.
Yeah.
I think that's, yeah, that would make sense for you not to have enjoyed it,
right,
really,
right.
Because it's not designed for you, and it's not designed for you to be sitting on your own with your trousers around your ankles watching it as you normally do.
Well, thank you for just suggesting it. No, I stumbled into a much more interesting Halloween type film called Vicious. This is a recent, this is on Paramount Plus and Amazon Prime and stuff. And this is a horror film directed by Brian Bertino. And this is much more interesting. It's not a brilliant film by any stretch, but it's an interesting concept, and it's something that we've kind of seen done before. There's a girl that's living in a house. She's a bit kind of antisocial, and she doesn't fit in with anyone, and she fails at most things in her life, played by Dakota Fanning really, really well. But there's a lady that knocks on the door, and she has got this box, and she puts it on the coffee table, and out from the box comes this huge, great big egg timer. There's a daft story going on about the fact that the person that gets given this box has to do three things in order to make sure that they don't die that night. And the three things are that you have to put something in the box that you hate, something that you love, and something that you need. Otherwise, the box and the spirit or whatever it is going on behind it, which you never see, incidentally, is going to make sure that you die. So part of the whole idea here is that you don't know what qualifies as the things that you've got to put in the box. You've got to guess. She's got to guess. And so she starts guessing, and it all gets very grisly and horrific and terrifying because of the things that she tries to put in the box. I don't want to say any more than that, because if you're going to watch it, you want to just be enjoying the unravelling of the story. So very, very good atmospherics going on. Watch it ready, though, for Dakota Fanning's performance in the central role. She holds the film and the story together, daft as it may be, but she's very convincing, and she demonstrates the required emotion and frustration and terror and all the rest that goes along with it. It's got a really chilling atmosphere around it, even if it is daft and kind of been done before. But there's some interesting lighting and shadow work going on with the kind of photography and so forth. And it's quite a good little psychological thriller stroke horror stroke spooky Halloween thing. I think it was good fun.
Cool. Yeah, it does look pretty good. I do like Dakota Fanning. She's always reliable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's a very precocious actress. I mean, obviously as a child, she was incredible in any of those early things that she did, most notably Taken, you know, Spielberg's big magnum opus about the alien abduction thing.
Yeah,
she was really great in that.
Mm-hmm. She was also
that TV show.
Yeah, yeah.
She was also in Man on Fire. She was the little girl in the Man on Fire film. And she was also in Ripley. We talked about Ripley on the show, didn't we? The one with, you know, matey in it, Andrew, what's his name? The eight part thingy with Andrew Scott when he played Scott. Ripley. Yeah. So she was also in that. She played the girlfriend or the ex-girlfriend or something. So she's very good, yeah. Anyway, those were my attempts at a Halloween-type theme. Who's next?
Well, I'll quickly interject here, because in typically Woost-like form, I don't have the stomach for supernatural scary stuff, but I am persevering with the Persuaders. And episode 15, tonight's episode, was a spooky episode within a cold open all about a black magic ritual killing. Whoa! stuff for Uncle Al. But I watched it, you know, during the daytime with the curtains open and everything, so it was okay. But the really truly frightening thing about it was just the complete lack of interest in any plot or quality acting from anybody. You honestly got the feeling that the team had just bungled this story together at about 6 a.m. after a couple of nights boozing in the hotel, because they do not give two hoots in the latter episodes about, you know, like, plot holes or anything. It's just hokey, chauvinistic fun, and I say that as a strong positive. But yeah, it wasn't scary at all. My vote for a scary film would be The Shining, and for the most disturbing film I've ever seen, you know, that's a fictional, supernatural or weird feel outside of anything like war or whatever crime, would be Eraserhead, which doesn't really fit as a horror film. I would say it is a horror film, but it's a surrealist horror film. And Kubrick actually said it was the most disturbing film he'd ever seen.
Right. Mm. Yeah, I liked Eraserhead. It was great. I thought
it's a masterpiece.
Just, yeah, off the wall, bizarre, art house, pure art house horror.
But I couldn't watch it again because it makes you feel queasy inside. It makes your mind or your spirit just feel queasy, not your body. It's really weird. Really weird movie.
Hmm. Okay. Gareth.
All right. I have two little films, one of which is scary. The other one is not. But I'll address the one that's not, because it's something that people probably are intrigued to see. It's a Netflix thriller with Keira Knightley and Guy Pearce called The Woman in Cabin 10. This is a kind of a murder mystery, and it's got a plot that is quite dense. It's got a lot of things going on in it to keep you intrigued as to what is going on and why it's going on. My big problem with the film is that it's entirely foreseeable because, well, there's certain people cast in certain roles, and you're like, well, they're obviously cast there because they are special to the story. And by the time the climax comes around, it all feels a bit hokey. And there's like a little
tiny bit of excitement at the end as people run around and guns are produced and things like that. And it's just ineptly filmed. It all takes place on a very attractive luxury pleasure super yacht thing, pleasure cruiser thing, as a millionaire takes his sort of close friends and business colleagues up to Norway because his wife is due to pass away due to some very nasty cancer that she happens to have. And along the way, they're going to have a bit of a party and a sort of memorable send-off for her. And she's going up there to sign things, to take care of business. And Keira Knightley's a journalist who goes along for the ride. And during the night, she hears a disturbance and runs out on deck to see someone being thrown overboard and drifting away into the night. Whenever she reports this, they're unable to work out who it was who was murdered. Everyone starts to think that she is a bit nuts. So she spends the rest of the film trying to track down who it was and why it was. It's fine. It's a really lightweight Agatha Christie-style murder mystery with some beautiful scenery. But crucially, the scenery doesn't really enter into it too much. They seem to be a bit more absorbed with the super yacht and filming the super yacht. But it's a nice change of pace because where if this had been filmed in the Caribbean or the Bahamas, it would have been scorching skies and beautiful tropical waters and things like that. Instead, here it's quite cold. You know, out on the deck, they're walking across the deck. She meets the crew and things like that on the deck, and the wind is howling across them, and you can feel, yeah, I want to go back inside and sit down in the plush sofas and things that they have around the inside of the ship, the yacht. The cast is good in that. Well, I always root for Guy Pearce. He's one of the best actors we have of this day and age. Art Malik is there, who a lot of you might know from something like The Living Daylights. He's in there. Paul Kay, or I think he did Dennis Pennis, didn't he? Waddingham and David Morrissey. So it's got a good cast of familiar faces and people who do good work. And most of the cast don't really do too much. I think Guy Pearce probably filmed all of his stuff in maybe a week. And all the rest of them did a couple of days here and there, whereas the bulk of the movie surrounds Keira Knightley as she's running around trying to discover what's going on and sticking her nose in where it doesn't belong or isn't wanted.
She'd be very
it passes
welcome.
The time. I liked how she stood up to the
brigade recently as well. Wasn't she in the news since we were last speaking because somebody asked her about your film, isn't it controversial because of this, that, and the other? And she just kind of rolled her eyes and just said, no, it's not really. So that all backfired. It was good to see, you know, actors and actresses in the establishment just kind of going, look, let's have some common sense here.
And she does. She's a good actress. I don't mind her. I did really feel that she and Daisy Ridley should make a film together because they have the same smile and the same kind of teeth maneuvers going on. That's kind of a lovable underbite, overbite, whenever they want it. Yeah, it's an underbite, I suppose. I think they would be quite well cast together as sisters or something like that. But have either of you two even heard of this?
No, I don't think so.
The woman in Cabin 10 was doing the rounds in the MeWe group, and the general consensus was, yeah, it's a kind of Agatha Christie, very light, and there was some enthusiasm to begin with, but when people started watching it, they kind of said, ah, don't bother, you know, it's all right, but, you know, you won't lose anything out by not watching it. That was the general tone.
Yeah, No, that's absolutely spot on. It's entirely forgettable, and I'm having trouble remembering even. Well, I know how the resolution was, but I can't even remember the actual ins and outs of how it all gets resolved. I remember there being a fairly decent scene at the end before all the Chasey's shenanigans as they take down the actual killer.
My dad enjoyed it, but then he liked Virgin River.
Well, you know, it's not too late to disown him. You know, he's old enough to know better.
It's lightweight, flimsy stuff that'll satisfy.
Yeah.
The other film I wanted to mention was a bit of a horror outing, because it's been sitting on my watch list for a long time. And I was a bit confused by it, because I put it on and I started watching it going, I think I have seen this, but I couldn't quite put my finger on whether or not I had actually seen it. It just feels so familiar. It's a found footage horror film from 2011 that gets really good reviews whenever you go delving into the what's the best found footage horror movie out there. A lot of people have a lot of good things to say about this, and I think that's where the problem came from, my confusion came from, because parts of this film have been lifted out and put into other films over the years, and as a result, you've seen everything that happens here. And whilst it doesn't do anything particularly wild or crazy, it's still early enough in the lifetime of found footage horror films that it was still relatively novel and new, so it didn't have to try too hard to be inventive. It gets pretty much everything right beat for beat, and now it feels a bit run of the mill, but at the time it probably did the job. It's an Australian, I'd say it's a very independent production, which has a really cool backstory to it, because New South Wales, there's problems with the water, so they come up with this idea to start using the tunnels that are under New South Wales, where old subway tunnels that are filled up with water that collects in there after rain and stuff like that, and then, you know, sanitize that and put it out there so that people have water again. But whenever they started investigating it, people started going missing, and there was rumors of people living down there, the homeless going missing as well, and there's something in the tunnels. So a small news crew get their band together and head down into the tunnels to film it, and they've got a bunch of cameras around, and creepy things happen. There's a bunch of great locations. There's a bunch of really creepy atmospheric moments as things are in there, as these films do. I don't want to give anything away in case you haven't seen it, but the scare tactics are genuine and they work. Those that don't really do very well with found footage movies and feel a bit, you know, nauseous whenever the camera's being thrown around a bit, it happens quite a bit in this film, so it's probably not recommended if you didn't manage the Blair Witch Project without losing your lunch onto your lap.
I find this will probably very be underwhelming. Blair Witch? Yeah.
Oh, right, okay. Well, because that was the first of its kind.
It was a brilliant piece of marketing, primarily, I think, and really, really resourceful guerrilla filmmaking. But I didn't find it particularly scary, even though I think it rightly did play for atmosphere and weirdness as opposed to, you know, anything more ambitious visually. Very strong performances. Well,
that's the beauty of it. It isn't a scary movie. It's entirely in your head, and you get out of it what you want to. The tunnel plays in a lot more scares. There's a lot more scares along the way. And the body count isn't particularly high for this film, which I was a bit shocked at. Because the cast is quite small. Start with them. There's not many people that can get killed. Yeah. But, you know, I'm glad I watched it. And I'm still of the mindset that perhaps I did watch it at some stage and I've just forgotten it entirely over the years.
Perhaps you were in it.
But, the cast are pretty good as well. I think the one person, Steve Davis, who plays Steve Miller in this. It's his only film, and he's one of the central characters in this. And he's pretty good, but he seems to be a cameraman on a lot of other Australian TV, cinematographer on news events and things like that. But he's obviously plays a cameraman in this, being a cameraman filming things.
That's a nice retouch, isn't it?
Two birds, one stone.
Yes.
But he gives a damn good performance. He's a wee bit annoying because he's a bit of a dick. But he does quite well in this film. And I would be curious to see him do something else along the same lines. But that kind of adds to the novelty that it's a one-hit wonder here. The cast are good, the effects are good, the locations are fantastic. It's just a strong wee horror film if you're looking to watch something this Halloween.
Yeah.
There you go.
Good.
That'll be a lot. Ted, have you seen this, or you don't go for found footage ones?
I don't particularly like found footage. And the takeaway I've got from this is to go and try and watch Blair Witch, because I watched kind of 20 minutes of that when it first came out, and I just got bored with it. I just thought it was stupid. But
not yet.
The found footage thing. The trouble is that quite often they're about filmmakers making films or documentary makers making documentaries, and it's all like I'd rather just see the story, and perhaps Blair Witch will be a bit different for me in that respect. So perhaps I should just try harder with Blair Witch and forget about the tunnel, because I'm not sure about that at all.
Going back to them now, I don't know that they would do very well. I did watch The Blair Witch when it came out in 4K there, and I still get chills in the last few minutes of it, because it is that effective, and I was there in the cinema whenever it first happened. So
how come for me? So how come, Alan, you didn't get that? You were okay with The Blair Witch?
Yeah, I didn't. No, I just I think, well, part of it actually was watching it with mates. He had just got a PC that played DVDs, if you can imagine, and we were sharing one chair in his new house, and so we were cramped, frozen, and watching it on a glorious 11.5-inch computer monitor from, you know, PC World or something. So I suspect the immersion wasn't exactly what the filmmakers intended. Okay. But yeah, I remember thinking, gosh, it's well acted and stuff, and it was atmospheric, but I didn't really get blown away or disturbed by the ending.
Right.
No.
Okay. You know, I just thought, don't really get it.
Well, you know, in the dark of the cinema, and it is a film where 99% of it, nothing really happens. There are moments. There are 93% of the film, nothing happens. But whenever scary things do start happening, you know, I guess it's an audience participation thing again, where you start to hear other people going, "Oh, a bit scared," and you start getting scared too, because they're a wee bit scared.
Yes.
And enjoying it with them, because everyone's suffering the same emotions. So, you know, that works. And it's The Grudge as well. I remember it was almost like a roller coaster. Everyone was on that. The audience was so loud as the scares arrived.
It's quite a gruesome movie, though, isn't it? The Grudge, isn't it a bit more overtly, you know, schlocky and horror?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's got a good gore factor, that tell me it. But it on a mass viewing, everyone was having a good time, and that's something that you can't capture when you're sitting watching something at home.
I don't approve of people having a good time. It's not to be encouraged.
No.
We don't like that here.
Right, okay then. Well, there's a few samples of Halloween-y type stuff going on there. So links in the show notes, as always. Probably the best kind of picks in that little lot for a bit of a Halloween thing is Vicious or The Tunnel, by the looks of it, unless you're a Persuaders fan. And then you can track down episode 15. Link in the show notes. It's the whole of that episode, free to watch on YouTube. So do that if you fancy. Right, coming soon. Gareth, what have we got coming soon?
Well, we'll start with Korean? I think it's Korean. Yes, it is. It's a Korean action crime flick called The Old Woman with the Knife. Or as it's in Korean, I think it's Pagwa. It's not quite as impactful name for the movie, but an aging assassin with a knack for taking out society's worst encounters a young protege eager to learn the trade. As they form an unlikely bond, the veteran killer discovers fresh purpose in her twilight years of violence and routine. Ted, I thought of you when I watched this and thought he's gotta like this.
You're quite right. I did. There was an interesting there's subtitles going on, and at one point someone says to the old woman, "What do you want?" And she says, "Mutual suffering." That's really funny. But I was all over this. As soon as I discovered it wasn't American, I have to say, it looked really, really good fun. And I was just thinking that if the Americans had made this, it would have just been cheesy and rubbish. But because it's Korean, I think it gives it the pass. And even if it is cheesy, it won't matter because it looks like... Anyway, I fancy the Mad Granny film myself. Alan?
I'm afraid I'm not man enough for that. It just looked savage. It was too... I don't really like that really graphic knife crime stuff. Even the trailer made me wince on a number of occasions, which is supposed to. It looks like it's very good at what it's doing. It ain't for me, mate.
All right. Well, next up, we have a new film from John Carnahan, a film director who I continually support and give my loyalty to because he's made some of the greatest crime thrillers of the last 20 years. This one is a docudrama called Not Without Hope. And I'm going to wait for you guys to slag this off for being, you know, like a TV movie, because it has that feeling of a TV movie. It's based on a true story about a bunch of guys who go out on a boat fishing and get hit by a storm. It's not a perfect storm, but it's slightly smaller in scale and smaller in story. Alan? You've got to appreciate something here. No,
okay. Not really. It just looked so what? It's just like a cheaper version of stuff that we've seen a zillion times before. I thought it looked really Faker Baker as well. Like we've discussed before, you know, if you're going to do, you remember we were talking about the Paul Greengrass film earlier, you know, how effective most of those big firescapes were. Water just seems to be so difficult to do properly, and a lot of that just, it really does pull the, you know, the rug from the carpet if you're just highlighting how artificial the thing is, obviously. Yeah. So, you know, that really just completely implodes the whole thing for me. Just, nah.
Okay, Ted, you're going to shock me by going, actually, I really want to see this.
Well, I want to see the second half of it. That's the trouble, because the whole kind of American macho men buddies thing, just in the trailer, it went on like for half of the trailer, the whole getting to know each other crap. And once it got into the water and it started happening, I thought, yeah, this is a different film. It's a bit like that film I was speaking about earlier that I put into room 101 into Flop of the Fortnight. Take off the first half of it, or the first hour of it in that case, and you know, you haven't missed anything and you just get to the action. Now this one might be rescued a bit because we know it's a true story, but did you, Alan, you must have picked this up in this trailer, this whiny irritating music going on in the background which was just annoying and crap, and it was like documentary kind of music. Ugh.
Oh gosh, no, I hadn't noticed that. Right, that's really interesting. Yeah, we voted a hard pass.
Yeah, I'll watch the second half of it.
There you go.
Okay, next up is a British prison movie called Waste Man, and it stars David Johnson from Alien. He played the robot-y dude, the android synthetic dude in Alien. What was that recent one called? The recent Alien movie, Romulus.
Alien Earth, or oh, right, okay.
No, the film there, yeah.
All right, yeah.
This follows Parolee Taylor, whose fresh start hopes are jeopardized by cellmate Dee's arrival. As Dee takes Taylor under his wing, a vicious attack tests their bond, forcing Taylor to choose between protecting Dee and his own parole chances. It doesn't sound like much from the description there, but sitting through the trailer, this looks to be, you know, kind of wildly violent and fast-moving, set around the British prison system and how nasty it can be in those cells, and prisoners can be with a fairly big plot to it as well. I think there's going to be some sort of big reveal mystery to solve as it goes on. Teb, what do you think of this? You like prison movies, don't you?
I do, yeah. You've got to really hope that this is just fiction, though, and that British prisons are not really like this, and that prisoners don't have to endure this kind of horrible kind of stuff going on. It looks scary.
It shouldn't be a hotel, mate.
I know. There's somewhere in between the two, isn't there? This looks a scary place, and of course the story looks like it's going to be gripping. But I don't know. It's just like, for goodness sake, do people really behave this way? I can't believe that they do.
They do.
No.
Yes, they do.
No. But I shall be intrigued to watch it.
I know you like the shower scenes, don't you? So,
Scum for 2025.
I thought it looked absolutely harrowing and horrifyingly convincing. Yeah, it looked like something I really don't want to watch because it was so well made.
And it's just tough. It oozes toughness. It's going to be a hard viewing. I'm looking forward to it, actually.
Yeah.
Next up is Begonia, which is a new, alien invasion sci-fi movie, sci-fi comedy, I suppose, about two conspiracy-obsessed men who kidnap the high-powered CEO of a major company, convinced that she is an alien intent on destroying planet Earth. Mm-hmm. It sounds quite bonkers, and it stars, a lot of Ted's favourite people. Emma Stone and Jesse Plemons are in there, along with Alicia Silverstone, who's one of mine. Ted, obviously you are excited about this.
It looks completely bonkers. I really liked Poor Things that I saw recently. I did mention that on the show a few months ago, which was completely nuts. The Lobster, completely loopy. Yorgos Lanthimos, hopefully I can never pronounce that properly. He just makes these amazing films that are just nutty and bonkers and great to watch. And yes, Emma Stone and Jesse Plemons in good form. I'm really looking forward to this, as I do with all of his work, bar none. I don't think I've ever seen anything by him that I haven't thought was just great. Alan?
I would largely agree with that because I wasn't listening.
Right, okay.
You can tell I'm a bluffer anyway, can't you? What was that? I'm so sorry to be so rude. Yes, I thought that this was excellent. It perhaps initially kind of a bit annoying, but that's the setup. And yeah, splendidly nuts. Totally agree with you. Plemons is terrific. Emma Stone is very sexy. And yet in this looks really, really annoying as well. So, yeah, I definitely want to check this out.
Mm-hmm.
And also Aliens. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Aliens. Yeah. Well, I don't know if anyone's told you, but Christmas is right around the corner.
No call for that sort of language.
And remake a classic Christmas tale, which is lovely to hear, because you can think about all the wonderful Christmas tales there were. There's a Christmas Story, and then National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, and Silent Night, Deadly Night, because we're getting a new Silent Night, Deadly Night movie based around the original, and it's coming on December 12th to a cinema near you. A child witnesses his parents' murder by a man in a Santa suit. Years later, as an adult, he dons a Santa costume himself and embarks on a violent quest for retribution against those responsible for the traumatic events of his childhood. Silent Night, Deadly Night was a long-running series of films that I think whenever the first one came out, Mickey Rooney went ballistic about and said that it was the most horrible, sort of savage thing that we and should not be on the screens. And he actually mounted a protest about it as well. Mm-hmm. So much so that they cast him in the fifth entry in the series because he was quite happy to take the money.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Really, really, truly?
Oh, that's a true story, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So they've brought the franchise back, which is great. And the trailer actually looked quite good. And early word is that it's quite a strong movie. So they're relaunching this franchise. What did you think, Ted?
Yeah, this looks great. I really fancy this. And it goes, as it goes on, this trailer, it gets funnier and funnier with each slay.
Oh!
Yes.
Oh!
And it's just, it just looks like really, really good fun. So I'm all over this. I must watch some of the other ones if it's a part of a series.
Yeah, you could do that in time for Christmas and have a ho 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 jolly special.
Yeah, Alan.
No, you know where I am on these things. I'd like to be cool with the kids and all, but no, I'm very Mickey Rooney, early stage Mickey Rooney with this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, Ted, I think you did last year. You watched the Black Christmas movies, didn't you?
Yes, I did. The three of those, I really enjoyed those. Well, the first two, anyway. But yeah, Silent Night, Deadly Night, I'll put it on my radar.
If memory serves, this is actually the second remake. I think they remade this a number of years ago. Silent Night from 2012, right? Yes, that was the first remake, so this is the second remake.
Okay.
All right, the last trailer we're going to talk about is the proper trailer for Pluribus, which is the new TV show from Vince Gilligan and stars Rhea Seahorn from the Better Call Saul. This follows the most miserable person on Earth and the one who must save the planet from happiness. Ted, is this biographical of you?
Alan will like this because it's about an alien. So Rhea Seahorn plays this kind of person who is not quite human and Earth-like. And it'll be really interesting, though, because Vince Gilligan just does some crazy imaginative stuff and he shoots it so well, as we know. All of us are all over Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad.
Yep.
He can do no wrong, really. So there's going to be nothing not to like about this. We've spoken about it before, but this is the first time we've had a proper trailer rather than a kind of, you know, 30-second teaser thingy. And it looks great. Can't wait. Alan?
Totally. Totally agree with you. It looks terrific. Rhea Seahorn is just riveting to watch in anything. She's wonderful. We've lost one. Somebody's gone.
Who's gone?
I don't know. I heard a plonk. Definitely heard a little plonk. Bling, plonk. Anyway, we're still there, so we'll persevere. Anyway, Rhea is terrific, and yes, this looked really interesting—a kind of zany, existential kind of black comedy. Looks very, very original. Very original.
Indeed. Yep. Yeah. Okay, we're good. Cool. We're good. All the links to those coming soons are in the show notes. Just before we go, one person in the final curtain, Gareth, which is very sad.
It is indeed. It appears we have now lost Prunella Scales, who I think most people would probably best know her for Fawlty Towers. Mm-hmm. and a bunch of other things. She was married to Timothy West, who we lost quite recently as well. But she starred in the likes of Howard's End, and I think she was in The Voice from Brazil, if memory serves, and a Jack Nicholson movie called Wolf. There was a TV series she made quite recently that was based on her and her husband going around the country, wasn't it? I can't remember what it was called, though. No, it's gone out of my head. As soon as I started talking about it, I started losing it. Maybe it wasn't even her.
Coastline, wasn't there a movie that we discussed a couple of times called Coastline?
It wasn't her, and though. It wasn't her.
Right.
Fair enough. Ted, you'd be a fan of her, wouldn't you?
Yeah. And the point I was making in the group when this happened was that she was so much more than Sybil Fawlty. And if you look at her credits in IMDb, 1952 was her first one, all the way through television. Lots and lots of stuff before she got anywhere near John Cleese in 1975 or 6, whatever it was, 75? 75. But then Fawlty Towers was so incredibly successful that that's what everyone thinks that she was and is, and that was her lot. But look at those credits, Alan. There's just tons of them, isn't
Nicholson
there?
Movies, holy smokes. I wasn't aware of that. I didn't realise that she was absolutely top tier. I mean, I knew she was a kind of like bastion of British television, and particularly comedy and stuff. And she was a much more attractive woman than, you know, the character really lets on in Fawlty Towers.
Yeah.
She's a really, really good looking lady. Mm-hmm. And what a long life, 93, full of wonderful projects and laughter and, hopefully laughter. You can never tell. I was watching something with Terry Thomas the other day. He was in an episode of The Persuaders, and I just recalled how much I loved him and what a lovable, avuncular figure he was. And I made the mistake of looking him up in Wikipedia and finding out that he had a terribly sad and ignoble demise. So it's not always the case that people, you know, have the life that you would wish for them, but hopefully she did. Do you know by any chance if her life was relatively happy and stable?
I think it was. It
sounds like it was. She was married for a good long time to Timothy West. So
good.
Yeah. I think she had a good life, and certainly entertained us for a long, long time. So,
exactly.
There you go. Prunella Scales, 93. Very sad. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another show. We're kind of done here today. So projectorroom.co.uk is our website where you'll get links to all the stuff we've been talking about. Podhub UK if you get lost. GarethMiles.com for Gareth and the unending flow of film reviews, which is just great. TedSalmon.com is where you'll find me and all the stuff that I do. Links to all of our audio podcasts and all of our MeWe groups you can find there as well. And so we'll be back in a fortnight's time. Do join us in the MeWe group. Let us know what you've been watching, and we'll bring highlights of that to the shows going forward. So hopefully you'll join us again next time in the Projector Room.